One of the truly great men of the age has died. And we have been watching this past week the pomp and circumstance of his canonization. Whatever judgment future historians may make of the role and the achievement of Winston Churchill, the popular mind has already raised him to the company of the immortal. Future generations of children will read his biography. And the teachers will quiz who was Winston Churchill. And the child will answer, he was the Prime Minister who saved England during the Second World War. Churchill had an even more exalted understanding of his meeting with destiny. Speaking in 1941, in the bleakest days of the war, he said to his people, "The Battle of Britain is about to begin, and on the outcome of this battle rests the survival of Christian civilization." Leaders are ordinarily credited with the blood and the sweat and the tears of the entire people. Mr. Churchill, of course, did not save England single-handedly, and surely he did not save Western civilization alone. But he gave to England in those dark days courage and a voice. He roused the determination, the dogged persistence which is at the base of English character. And he brought to the seat of power a rare competence and an unflagging energy which sped the war along and which saved us during that terrible Holocaust many of the ordinary follies which accompany military action. Mr. Churchill had spoken out against compromise and appeasement in the early 1930s. He was not convinced that the good need be weak. He was not a good Christian in the sense that he believed that the good must always turn the other cheek. He was an ardent disciple of preparedness. He felt that the decent, the civilized could triumph if they were determined, if they were strong, if they had the will and were prepared to sacrifice. During those years, those fateful years for the West, Mr. Churchill was a kol koreh bamidbar, a voice crying out in the empty wilderness. His generation had eyes, but they would not read the lines of Mein Kampf, and they had ears, but they would not hear what was being shouted into the microphones at Nuremberg. Mr. Churchill did not come to power until 1940, until those days when France was overrun in a 6 week blitzkrieg, to the evacuation of Dunkirk, when England alone was in active battle against Hitler. And Churchill's role was that of rallier, enthusiast. A BBC engineer who monitored many of Mr. Churchill's wartime programs said that Mr. Churchill had identified the two microphones that were before him on the table. On his left was that bloodthirsty guttersnipe, Corporal Hitler. On his right, his arch-villain companion, that whimpering jackal, Mussolini. And the anger that throbbed at these microphones crossed the airwaves. Churchill's iron will transmitted itself to his people, to the West. His was the voice that never broke. As long as his voice sounded out The hope. England had hope. Mr. Churchill was Joshua, encouraging the hosts of Israel. Chazak ve'ematz, al ta'achotz v'al techat, ki imcha Adonai Elohecha, v'chol asher telech. Be strong, be of good courage. Be not dismayed, be not affrighted, for the Lord your God, he will be with you wherever thou shalt go. We shall not flag or fail. We shall go on to the end. We shall fight in France. We shall fight on the seas and the oceans. We shall fight with growing confidence and growing strength in the air. We shall defend our island, whatever the cost may be. We shall fight on the beaches. We shall fight on the landing grounds. We shall fight in the fields and in the streets. We shall fight in the hills. We shall never surrender. And even if, which I do not believe for a moment, this island or a large part of it were subjugated and starving, then our empire beyond the seas, armed and guarded by the British fleet, would carry on the struggle until, in God's good time, the new world with all its power and might steps forth to the rescue and the liberation of the old. Azak ve'ematz, al ta'achotz v'al techat, ki imcha Adonai Elohecha b'chol asher telech. The measure of Mr. Churchill's courage and of his greatness said he somehow never failed to radiate this strengthening. How often we, in frustrated in our own lives, rush forth into bitterness and self-pity, give vent to our anger, turn against the world. How often we break and we stumble. Mr. Churchill never broke, and he never stumbled. We shall fight rang out to the English people as the hammer descends on the anvil. And it was repeated, and as it was repeated again, it struck sparks in the British soul. An encouragement. And they were strengthened. During the long war, during that long time when the odds were so desperate, when Churchill read daily the frustrating intelligence reports that were brought to him, he never once gave vent to fear, dismay. His step, his voice, never quivered. Only his aide, who was sitting next to him in the broadcast booth, heard Mr. Churchill's half-spoken postscript. We shall fight. We shall fight with beer bottles, he said, because that is about all that we have to fight with. Now, Mr. Churchill's immortality rests on his symbolizing the dogged determination of the West not to knuckle under to the Nazi malignancy. But his fame rests on a broad base. For he was a man of extraordinary accomplishments across an extraordinary long and full life. Mr. Churchill was an unusual statesman and politician. He came to the House of Parliament at the age of 25. He resigned his seat in the House of Parliament at the age of 90. Sir Churchill was first appointed to cabinet rank in England at the age of 31. He resigned his second prime ministership a full half century later, at the age of 81. No other man in the long history of England served his country in so many posts with such distinction over so long a period. Churchill was a statesman of vision, of clear judgment. Mr. Churchill was a politician who could enter the rough and tumble of an election fray, reach out and get the votes and get elected. But he was more than just a statesman. He was also a Nobel laureate in literature. Mr. Churchill in his youth had been one of the first of that new breed of roving war correspondents who went to the far corners of the world to write and to make history of the first blossoming of the emerging peoples fighting for their right to a place in the sun. As correspondent, as columnist, as novelist, as one of the great historians of our day, Mr. Churchill's literary output rivals in quantity that of any professional man of letters. And remember, he was fully occupied as a statesman during his whole lifetime. And in style and in quality, he needs take a second seat to none. Churchill's language has a majestic cadence to it. His writings are written with a sense of high drama. He knew how to exploit the King's English, in the latter years the Queen's English, to the full range of its beauty and its subtlety. Statesman and stylist, Mr. Churchill was also a public orator without peer. It is estimated that across his long biography, his long life, he gave some 25,000 speeches. And every one of them was written out and fully and accurately committed to memory. Now, God had given to Mr. Churchill an unusual set of vocal cords. He had a magnetic voice, but he alone, through his discipline, sculpted the English language into a tool which vaulted him into power. And he alone, by his discipline, trained himself to use this God-given instrument of his to move people, to move Parliament, to move his nation, and ultimately to move mankind. Statesman, stylist, speaker, Mr. Churchill was also one of the most acute and perceptive military strategists of the day. He was the first man to see the possibility of the armored car, the tank. The first tank was built in his backyard, and he saw to it that it was tried out on the fields of France. In 1913, as First Lord of the Admiralty, as the Navy Minister in the English government, Mr. Churchill drew up what he believed to be the German battle plans, the plan of attack, which the Kaiser's army would follow in 1914 or 15 if war with France were attempted. He took a position diametrically opposite to that which was being argued by all of England's most learned and famous admirals and generals. And Kaiser Wilhelm's troops were one day behind Mr. Churchill's uncanny predictions when they reached the Somme. He was one of the first defenders of air power and the creator of England's air force. 3 days before the outbreak of hostilities during the First World War, Mr. Churchill, on his own, against the consensus in the cabinet, without the authority of the king, organized a total enlistment of the naval reserve. All of England's ships were at sea when war broke out. One of the first times in history that a navy has escaped a Pearl Harbor at the beginning of an attack. Statesman, stylist, speaker, strategist, Churchill was also, I am told, a Sunday painter of more than ordinary competence. He first set brush to canvas in 1915. England was at war, and he was England's second-ranking cabinet officer in charge of its navy. You can imagine how much time he had. Without a lesson, during that 1 year, he developed his art in this field of painting to such a point that he was able to open in Paris in the fall of the year a one-man show under an assumed name. And I understand that the critical reception was quite agreeable to him. And Churchill had a monumental vanity, and the critics must have spoken quite well for Mr. Churchill to be satisfied. More could be said of him. He was a man of many, many parts. But we have said enough to indicate, I believe, that he possessed that quality which we associate with the Renaissance man, that inordinately broad sweep of interest. The world was his, and he wanted to be part of its each and every aspect. He possessed also, with the Renaissance man, that impatience with expertise. If a man told him something, he would check it. There were no fields of information which were too arcane for his mind to enter, to reason, to make judgment. There was no professional discipline which Mr. Churchill felt he could not gain, in which he could not gain some competence. And he shared finally with the Renaissance man that rather over-enthusiastic zest for life, which spills over at times into a lust for life. Mr. Churchill ate too much. He drank inordinately. He never listened. He was a monologuist. When he entered a room, he needed immediately to be the center of all attention. He dressed deliberately to get attention. He was not easy on his friends. I doubt that he had real friends. He was not particularly concerned with people's sensitivities. Mr. Churchill was not a saint, but he was a truly gigantic man. Now, there will be some who this week and in the weeks ahead rehearse Mr. Churchill's biography and carefully bleach from it all of the restlessness, all of that inordinate drive, what the English call pushiness, all of that intemperate quality, which was very much a part of the man. More's the pity. We do not choose our immortals for their innocence. And so there are always a busy band of rather prissy moralists who go about fumigating the dark corners of the lives of the immortals, lest some young person be misled. But why not see men as they were? All of us need to go to school, after all, in the art of living as much as we go to school for the art of reading. And many of us are held back. Many of us have great difficulty before we graduate. The measure of a man's merit is not a life of unbroken rectitude. The scale of his living, the measure of his maturity, the extent of his growth. We are not called upon to mimic and to ape the great, but only to have them set for us a standard of accomplishment, which can be ours. They raise our sights. We do not have to follow along, putting every step precisely in the footstep they took. Now, Mr. Churchill's youth was petulant. As a child, he was given to temper tantrums, to kicking his tutors, and he had a long succession of them, to sassing, to talking back. But the only thing that you can say about Mr. Churchill's youth is that it can give some aid and comfort to the distressed and the distraught mother who is accompanying her angel into the principal's office. Churchill's early life exhibits nothing more than the advantages of being born to a class society and at the top of the privileged class, and some of the emotional disadvantages of being to the purple born. Churchill was an undisciplined child. His parents were busy with high society and high politics. They had little time for him. He was given his head, and he often went off his head. He entered Harrow as a third from the bottom scholar in a large class. He never left the form, the grade in which he entered. And when he left Harrow 5 years later, he had proceeded to the point where he was the rock bottom scholar in his class. Only the fact that he was the son of Lord Randolph Churchill, the eldest son of England's second or third lord, gave the headmaster patience to put up with the escapades, the bitter wit, the ugliness of this young Peck's bad boy. He failed the examination for Sandhurst, the West Point of England, 3 times running. Only his birth allowed him to take the examination that many times. When he finally graduated without distinction from Sandhurst, he received a commission in a most undistinguished regiment. Few of England's officers wanted any part of him. His reputation had preceded him. And he used unabashedly the contacts, what we would call the pull of his family, to gain for him the leave and the leisure to take part in all of the hijinks of that age's jet set. He thought nothing of running down to Ethiopia for the hunt and running out to India for a polo match. He and the young bucks of his day spent 5 months a year in England's social swirl. Then they went back to soldiering. And whenever a young officer, commanding officer of his, attempted to break Churchill to the routines of the barrack and to his responsibilities, his orders would be countermanded from London. You could be sure that the chief of staff had been invited down to Blenheim Castle for a weekend and a shoot. Now, there are some who, looking at the early record of young Churchill, will argue, here you have it. Here is the proof of that contemporary anarchy which insists that we ought not to curb and to rein in our children. Give him his head. Give the young monster his head, he'll become another Churchill. I'm afraid that about all that Mr. Churchill's youth proves that if you are born the son of the President of the United States, you have certain advantages and people will be a little more patient with you than if you are the son of an ordinary citizen. Let's examine this contemporary philosophy of ours. It's really nothing more than an abdication of our responsibilities as parents. But somehow we have been led to believe that if we discipline the child, if we curb him, we will thwart some development in his personality. We will thwart something called his creativity. And he will make it impossible for him to be a full-blown, full-blooded man. And once our children find the advantage in this philosophy, the tactical advantage that it gives them, do we not begin to hear a good bit from them about the fact that society and the family are in a concerted conspiracy, a repressive conspiracy against their egos? And do they not justify to us all manner of bad manners as the freedom of expression, their need to work out their personalities? God spare them from such personalities. Mr. Churchill's youth was a wild one. Let it not be cited as proof of this absurd pedagogy. Mr. Churchill's youth stood him in bad stead. He had to overcome his privilege. He had to come to the realization that he was a dandy, a rather useless person in the way of things, before he came into himself. Mr. Churchill's youth led him to make many enemies, and many of these stood him in bad stead later on in his life. As a young officer, he'd wanted the thrill of joining in with Lord Kirchner in the relief of the British hero Gordon at Khartoum in the Sudan. Kitchener had already heard of Churchill and of his reputation for mulishness and pettishness and for arrogance, and he wanted none of the young buck. And he refused to add him to his army. He was overruled from London, and he never forgave. 20 years later, when Mr. Churchill was First Lord of the Admiralty, and when he had his pet project during the First World War of an attack on the Dardanelles, which he thought would break Turkey away from the Central Powers and speed the end of the war. Lord Kitchener was then the Commander-in-Chief of England's armies. And his delay, his carping, his finding fault with this project, doomed it to failure. And because of its failure, Churchill in his 40s was precipitated from office. Before he could win any glory, before he could achieve seniority, before he could see his pet plan, which was in itself well devised for victory, given a fair chance. No, let no one feel that the young can exhibit all manner of bad manners, step on any toes, and that they will be blessed by mankind for it. At the age of 25, Churchill entered the House of Parliament. His name, his family's rank, his own few moments of glory won him election. By the age of 26, Churchill had made himself so disrespectful to the elders of his own party. He had made such a bad name for himself among those of his own class that one day when he rose to speak in the Parliament, there occurred a scene never before and never after duplicated in English history. Every member of the Tory party, his own, rose noisily in his seat and left the room. And each stopped at the door and brayed like a donkey at this young man who was making such an ass of himself. Now, had not Winston Churchill been the son of Lord Randolph Churchill, he would have been doomed then and there to political oblivion. Churchill was fortunate in his birth in that its advantage allowed him a looser rope than is granted to most of us. But he himself came later on to realize that had he been more disciplined, he might have gone to Oxford or to Cambridge rather than to Sandhurst. He might have moved more steadily on in British politics and not had a career which went by fits and starts. He might have been able to end the First World War much earlier. Imagine the burden of guilt that lay for this fact across his soul. How did the young, impetuous Churchill grow up? How did he become a man? It's hard to say. But Churchill grew up as he began to hook on his ambition to a holy sense of purpose. I think he found himself in the barren, windswept hills of northern India. Churchill was posted to India because they needed a skillful left forward in a polo match. His army unit was stationed 2,000 miles to the south of the hill country. It was in the hill country and there alone that military operations were taking place. And after he'd contributed a few goals and drunk a few drinking bouts, Mr. Churchill tired of the life of Mysore, and he went up to northern India to have a shoot, much as you go grouse hunting in the Moor country. He wanted a thrill, he wanted some medals, he wanted some notoriety, nothing more. But somehow in those Pathan hills, Churchill saw something which bothered him. He saw the invincible military stupidity which seems to be a constant of all ages. He was disturbed at the way in which British military tactics exposed the military man, exposed the ordinary soldier to unnecessary danger and gave England unnecessary loss. He began to write about military strategy. He began to be concerned about the fate of his own nation. England's security somehow became his holy grail, his religion, the purpose to which he dedicated his life. And in that dedication, which was slow growing, did not come to him all at once, but in that dedication to England's security, in strength and in peace, Mr. Churchill became a man. I've often wondered what it is that makes a man, what it is that gives a life direction. As a teacher, I am tired of that constant echo. What are you going to do in life? I don't know. What do you want out of life? Happiness, maybe? I don't know. Most people, too many people, are born, and they live, and they work, and they die, and they know not why. What gives a life direction? I suspect that restlessness gives life direction. The young Moses was restless in Pharaoh's court. Others dallied there for all manner of luxury. But the young Moses was a restless boy. And he walked out alone into the fields. And one day on one of these walks, he chanced across that sadistic slave driver beating and whipping his miserable charge. And later on, that same young Moses, now in exile, became restless in Jethro's tent. And while the others stayed nearby and tended the sheep, he walked alone into the wilderness. He walked into his thoughts. He found in his walk alone, in his restlessness, the bush that burns but is never consumed, the direction in life towards which we go but we never quite reach, that which gives our life meaning, which pulls us up and pulls us in, so that we walk a steady and a straight way. And so it was with Mr. Churchill. He was restless in the south of India, and he went north for no good reason. And north he saw stupidity, and it concerned him, and he began to think. And later on, the next year, he went into the Sudan. He was restless. There was no good reason. He wanted a thrill. He wanted the shoot. And again he saw stupidity. And again he began to think. And a year and a half later, he again went to war for no good reason. He could have stayed in England and enjoyed the society there. He was restless. And he went to the Boer War. And again he became concerned with military tactics, with the way in which England's security was being managed. The restless young man became a purposeful adult. How do we go ahead in life? I've already cited to you time and again that symbolic direction given to us by the Bible. God commands Abraham, Lech Lecha, get you out of your homeland, get you out from your father's home, get you out from the place of your birth. Where shall we go? El ha'aretz asher areka. I'll show you along the way. Begin. You'll find the direction in the going. One job leads to another. One opportunity leads to another. Walk out on the Cleveland streets and you'll suddenly find a purpose, responsibility, An idea may come to you which will change your politics, your way of life. Certainly your composure will be broken. Begin to walk. You'll never find your future with a book about careers by your fireside at home. Life is learned in the living. Life is given direction in the going. The restless see more than the stay-at-home. The restless gain the vision. It is of the restless men that great men are born. Now, many men are restless. How is it that the extraordinary man separates himself out from the ordinary man? What makes for greatness? Who knows the full prescription, but there were two salient characteristics which appear in Mr. Churchill's life: his persistence and his daring. Men retire at 65. Mr. Churchill first became Prime Minister of England at 66. Men who are called back beyond their seniority during wartime, and it was wartime, when the war is over, retire to their pipe and to their honors. Mr. Churchill became Prime Minister again of Great Britain at the age of 77. Churchill did not know the 8-hour day and the 5-day week. He was dedicated to his country and to his work for 70 years. And if he was out of office, he was busy. His literary output would rival that of any professional. And when he was not writing, he was speaking. And when he was not speaking, he was building, or painting, or bricklaying, or any one of the many activities which occupied his time. The age of 23, Churchill was a young correspondent posted to the Boer War. The second day at the front, he was captured. He was taken back to Pretoria, the capital of the Boers, and there he managed to escape. He escaped alone. He made his way with great difficulty to a neutral port in a Portuguese colony, and he was much acclaimed. A ticker tape welcome awaited him in London. Here's a youngster, 23 years of age. Here is the shouting hosanna of his nation at his beck and call. Here is a man whose whole life has up till then been dedicated to the thrill, to the daring, to the gaining of medals. And what does he do? He goes back to the Union of South Africa. He goes back to the wars. He's not satisfied yet. He hasn't earned enough money from the newspaper, which is to pay his way, but that's not the main thing. He is not yet satisfied that he is ready to settle back into his honors. Churchill, all his adult life, refused being raised to a lord that he might continue in the House of Commons and active politics. His was a persistent dedication to what? To his ambition, yes. To his projects, yes. They came cascading out of his mind. They made for his greatness. If he had failed as a politician, we would have known him as a historian. If he failed as an historian, we would have known him as a strategist. If he had failed as a strategist, we probably would have found him the first man on the moon, or in some other unexpected place. Mr. Churchill was a man of daring. Far more than you and I, he enjoyed the good things of life. He was quite a drinker. He spent money lavishly. As a young man of advantage and family, he could have settled back to a life of ordinary routine and fully expected that by normal progression, by middle age, he would have won honor and wealth, power and position. Churchill was in the enviable position of having to gamble nothing. The family business, the governing of the English Empire, was his. But he gambled. He took the difficult way. He was going to be his own master. He was going to forge his own destiny. He was going to sculpt his own funeral service, the eulogy which would be spoken. He would not take the easy way, but his own way. And he knew the cost. If you walk alone, if you break with tradition, if you break away from routine, if you refuse to enter Father's business, there are going to be setbacks. The way is not smooth. It's rutted and filled with detours. Churchill lost 5 elections out of 20. 80 days after Churchill had made his famous V for victory sign into reality, 80 short days after the end of the war, he was turned unceremoniously out of office by the British electorate. He knew the gamble he was taking. He knew that he was throwing away security. He knew that he might be a poor man, that he might dissipate his wealth and dissipate his rank and dissipate his privilege. But he chose to do so. And so must any. So must any man who dreams of daring do. You cannot find greatness following the well-rutted grooves in the highway. You must walk your own way. You must take chances. You must be prepared to know the slings and the arrows of the most outrageous of fortune. And you must be a realist, one who knows that most friends are fair weather, one who admits that electors can be fickle, one who knows that few forgive and few forget, one who knows that all the honors are empty honors unless your strength does not diminish, your mind does not dim, unless you can continue to stay abreast and ahead. Persistence, daring. These, in a major way, are the qualities of the few. Of the few who break out of the shield of anonymity. Of the few who make history flexible. Who twist destiny to their own ends. How grateful we must be to the few. They remind us, do they not, that we are not prisoners hobbled to some malign fate, that our future is not written in the stars or in some textbook which sets out iron laws of sociology or of economics. We are the masters of our fate if we are prepared to fight for it. If we are prepared to sacrifice and to dare and to persist. And so we end as we began. The teacher will ask, who was Winston Churchill? The child will answer, Winston Churchill was the prime minister who saved England during the Second World War. And the word of wisdom will add, it was Mr. Churchill and the blood and the sweat and the tears and the dedication and the will of his people that saved the nation. We can be grateful for the few, but we who are the nation of the peace-loving and the justice-seeking, we who believe in civilization, we too must be of the daring. We too must be of the persistent. We too must be among those who walk alone, who make their own judgments, who are willing to sacrifice privilege and convenience and comfort to the shared hopes and goals of mankind. Amen.